Welcome to Authors of the Pacific Northwest, where we connect Pacific Northwest authors with new listeners and provide advice for aspiring authors on the business of writing. I'm your host, Vicki J. Carter.
Hey there, listeners. Thank you so much for coming back to the podcast this week. I am super excited for the author that we have this week, and I'm going to try to contain my excitement so that we can get through everything. But we have a four-time award-winning author, Lynn Burnell. So Lynn, say hello to all of us.
Hello.
Hi, Lynn. So I'm going to give you guys a little bit of background about Lynn, and then I'm going to have her talk about her book that she's featuring for this podcast, because she actually is quite an established author. And so we're going to handle this podcast a little bit differently than we've done with others. So first off, Lynn was a writer for Bill Nye the Science Guy, that show, which is awesome, one of my favorite shows. So Lynn, when your bio, you talked about being an award-winning author for that. Can you share a little bit about your background, how you got into that part of it? And then we can start talking a little bit about some of your book titles, because it's extensive. So tell us about yourself. And what state in the Pacific Northwest do you live in?
Oh, I live in Washington.
Yay!
Yay, I'm Washington! and I came here because of Bill Nye the Science Guy. I was living in New York City. So I can go way back. I used to be a classroom teacher. My first assignment as a teacher was way back in the day when they would take kids that were quote unquote behavior problem children, and they would take them out of the mainstream classroom and stick them in a classroom, and that classroom was my classroom. So I had 30 kids, grades 4 through 8, who were the quote unquote behavior problem kids. And aside from two, which were kind of scary, most of the kids were
great. Yeah.
In a completely different way. So it taught me really early. It was a real formative thing for me as a an educator and a communicator to sort of see that not everybody learns the same way. And mm-hmm. to be faced with, that and puberty, a room full of puberty at the same time, was real, it was like boot camp. It was great. And so I found my way in from teaching into publishing. And then I saw early episodes of Bill Nye on TV, and I thought, I want to do that. That's going to be my job. And so I reached out and luckily got the job. So it was great.
Awesome. So you have a science background though, correct? You have, from what I understand, you have English and science background. Is that correct?
I do. I fell in love with biology in high school. I was going to be a veterinarian when I went to college.
Oh, and, yes.
I love biology. I love science. And, but then I fell in love with Shakespeare, and I love Shakespeare. And
oh, yeah.
And I art, and I majored in a bunch of different things, and but to me they're all connected. It's all about discovering the world and experimenting and looking and problem solving. So it's not, people would say, oh my gosh, you majored in English and art and biology, how can you do that? I'm like, because it's all kind of the same, really.
Oh, I get it 100%. I landed in IT as a librarian. So I have a library science degree with an IT background. So everybody at my work knows me as a IT person, but I landed into library science because it's so much research, and I love English lit. English lit was actually my love. And when I couldn't figure out how that would translate to work, because so I'm like, I could teach great, awesome, but so now I'm finding how it translates into my work and life. But yeah, so I totally get it. But so if I could, I would have majored in a million things, but I started school much later than most people.
I think it also, it sort of kicks in, it starts to gel when we get a little older. It's that's how it fits in.
I love it. I love it. So you have 45 titles under your belt, which is phenomenal. And you've been writing for quite a long time. And this is one question I ask every single author that comes on this podcast. For you, talk us through that aha moment when you realized you're an author and this is something you were going to do. Do you remember that moment, and talk us through it?
Well, I always had ideas. I always had thoughts. When I started working in publishing, my first publishing job, I was an editorial assistant at Scientific American Books for Young Readers. And they wanted to do a brand new imprint for kids. And their idea was that the top scientists in the world will write these science books for kids, which right there, I'm sure you can probably figure out the problem there. The top scientists, real kids, top people. write a kid's book. So I was thrust into this world of like intense science that really needed to be communicated. So my teaching background really helped me.
Oh, yes.
The publisher and me. So we would get these, we got one, it was like a 360-page, you know, tome from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory that talked all about the politics of like the Voyager. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how about if we do a 32-page picture book where we show pictures of Saturn and the moon and the rings? And so it was really fun to be kind of thrown into that. And that was sort of an aha moment of, oh, in the classroom, I reach this many kids. In publishing, it's a different thing. You have to lead, your reader from the cover to open up the book and then from page to page. And then from there to go to TV where you just have to keep the person watching. So it's all kind of connected that way. I think, you know, that's where I have little aha moment. I still have aha moment.
That's good, because you realize that you're a lifelong learner, you know, and that's the best part about this whole journey for anybody. And for me particularly, is this becoming, I mean, I love learning. And so it just translates into anything I do in writing.
Oh, and I think, you know, everybody that we meet can teach us something. Did Mr. Rogers say that? Because it sounds like something he would
say. It does. It sounds like a Mr. Rogers. Yeah. So you touched a little bit on your TV career, and this is something that is really interesting for me. And I wanted to branch out just a little bit of a discussion with you about this, because you've been doing the process already. You're quite a farther along than many authors that I've met or I'm working with, as far as branding yourself and getting out there. And you have great publicity. You've been on several TV shows, just to name a few. You've done some with NPR and ABC TV. I thought it was great. You've done Martha Stewart Radio, which is awesome. You do the NBC Newsday TV for the Northwest, which is pretty awesome. You have a huge resume. So that is not a common thing for authors starting out to know, or even have the skills to kind of get in to other aspects of the writing. Well, not say writing, but the business. And so talk us through kind of what you would suggest on a small scale for somebody like me, because I'm obviously doing the podcast because I love to talk and meet people. But what are some tips you can suggest for other authors about how to pace themselves and find those opportunities, like TV opportunities, things like that? What are some good ideas?
Well, you know, and you know, again, it's something that I'm continuously learning, I think, and because the landscape is changing, right, with all the social media. And so you're on top of it there.
I am busy on social media.
I think until recently, I still, you know, and I still am learning this, that, you know, I have so many ideas and I go off in all these different directions. And I think it was an interview that I saw with Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote Hamilton. And he was being interviewed, I think, by Charlie Rose. And he was saying that how when he went to high school, he was surrounded by all these really brilliant people, and that he needed to, like, you know, figure out what he was. He wasn't the funniest one in the room. He wasn't the smartest one in the room. And so he just sort of found his place, and he started running. He picked a lane. Mm-hmm. God, that was really... I liked thinking about that, because I had not picked a lane, and I was like a center going off in all these different directions. And until I picked the lane of, you know, I guess science is my lane, right? And I can put it all in. And it doesn't mean that if I brand myself as a science writer, that takes anything away from anything else that I do. But it's a weird thing we have to get over in our, it's a brand. Like, you know, you can just write books, but if you think about it in terms of a business, who you are as an author, it really does help. And then you can use social media, and then you can use these things, and then they lead to, I mean, all the TV stuff that I've had, it's always been, they've come to me. I've never really pursued.
Oh, how exciting is that?
It is, I know. And I think,
I'm waiting for the door to bust down in my area.
I think it's luck with that kind of stuff. I mean, sometimes it comes from publicity, and if you have a good bearing and hold yourself up in a certain way, I think, you know, people like that, and they might pursue coming back to you and having you become someone that they talk to, which is what really happened with the New Day Northwest. Margaret Larson is the host, so she's wonderful. And I went on, I think, to talk about Mama Gone Geek. I think I just had
your title book. Yeah, yeah.
And I brought science experiments, and we did them together, and we had so much fun. It was like Lucy and Ethel. So they have me back, and it's fun. We just have fun together. So that was just a nice chemistry thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I'm finding. So I'm very new into all this. Right. And I am working on the social media aspect of it, and as well as podcasting. I fell in love with podcasting and from listening to podcasts, and I'm like, oh, I can do that. That's something I can do. And every single step and every author has almost like opened up this amazing bridge of new people and new opportunities. But the one thing that I've talked about on the podcast before, and I tell people all the time, first I had to say yes. First I had to say, okay, I'm going to be fearless, because that was my word this year. I'm going to be fearless. And a lot of people, when they first meet me, they don't realize that I am an introvert, because I have these extrovert tendencies, right? I can survive because I'm an extrovert. And also I'm very passionate. And so they don't realize that I also have fears like everybody else, because I jump in and I'm like, sure, I'm going to try this and be fearless. So this year was the fearless. I'm going to do the podcast. I'm going to start meeting authors. I'm going to start putting myself out there. And then I get these incredible cool opportunities to meet people like you. And it's like, how amazing is that? So I love that you are reiterating for our listeners and other aspiring authors out there. I hope today you and I will help inspire them to be fearless and just follow that path. Just go for it and see what comes your way.
No, I think that's true. It's true. That's true.
See who busts down our doors.
And I have to do that too. Like, I'll say to myself that what my word last year's phrase that I would say is send a ship out every day, send a ship out, whether that means send an email to someone, reconnect, connect with someone who I admire in terms of professionally, write an idea, share it with somebody. So send a ship out every day, because if you send a fleet out, something is going to come back.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to borrow that and listen to it in my head all the time. That's beautiful. Thank you. So that's a great tip. I always kind of feel like because I have a day job still, so I call this podcast and my writing career my side hustle. And sometimes it gets a little tiring, and many authors are doing the same thing I'm doing. And sometimes for me, the best I can do is say, if I just do one thing on my side hustle, then I'm doing good in the day.
And you know.
I love the ship. I love that analogy. And I hope everybody else that's listening, grab that one, because it's a good one. So let's talk about the two books. So you mentioned one book, Mama Gone Geek, and you also have a blog. So tell us about that. And then we're going to jump into the one I'm super excited to talk about.
So Mama Gone Geek was a little bit of an offshoot for me, because it was a memoir, kind of I think it's technically called a parenting memoir. But for me, it was just stories, because I had two babies and they were growing up, and you know, you meet with these tough situations, you know, like that every parent has, you know, where do babies come from? Why is this happening? What's going on there? You know, when they get stitches, you know, all these things, right? And I found this inner calmness when I would be able to step back and lean into my inner nerd. And like, you find amazing, beautiful metaphors in science. And you find them anywhere. But you know, I would be doing work in the science and I'd be like, oh my God, that is beautiful. I could totally apply that knowledge to this situation. And so that's what it was. It's sort of funny and it's sort of heart, you know, breaking all at the same time. And but it weaves it in, and it just sort of shows that, like, having that ability to just retweak the lens, just look at things, and then be able to do that for the kids.
Yeah.
Like, tweak it for them and then come up with some sort of fun experiment for them to do that, you know, can help, you know, layer that on. So that's what Mama Gone Geek is. And it's a lot of people think, well, I'm not gonna read it, I don't have kids. It's like, well, it's not really about how to, you know, how to parent. It's how I leaned in. It's how I took those science, those heavy, cool, almost inaccessible moments, and refocused that lens and made it make sense in my environment. So it's that's what that book was. That's it.
Oh, super cool.
Yeah,
I love it. I love it. So let me ask you, did your kids go into science, or are they creatives? What are they doing in their world?
Yeah, they're still, you know, young, 13 and 15 now.
Okay. So they're leaning towards it.
I think that, you know, they like science. They love science. They don't love reading, which just makes me
crazy. Oh, mine didn't either. A shocker. I they were not readers.
I know, until they got older. Like, don't tell your writer mother you don't like
I books. Know. Oh, trust me. We went around. Then they found anime, so that helped a lot.
That's good. That's right. They like that stuff. They like music. So I would say they're creative, but you know, they're figuring out what they love, which is neat. My older son, he's amazing at chemistry and physics. I knew he would be. He's very mathematical, and that's fun for him in a way that the way I found biology fun is how he finds like physics. Yeah. Math fun, which is great. How do they have a passion? I don't really, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, our kids are older, and so they're starting out in creative life now.
Oh, yeah.
And so they've always been, I've always pushed, you know, science and arts and creativity, and they get that a lot. So it's so fun to watch them develop from all those lessons we taught them, and then they start using that in their life. You know, and they're being very creative. So how exciting.
Are they using that in their real lives?
Oh yeah, they are. Yeah. One is graphic design and web design, and the other, she's a makeup artist, creative makeup artist. Yeah. So, I mean, and a lot of people, makeup is creative. Oh, you should see some of the stuff they come up with. It's beautiful.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. So super great. So, one other thing I wanted you to touch on, because I thought this was also beautiful and fascinating and very supportive of women. So, and that's another theme that runs through everything I do, is tell us a little bit about your speaking engagement at the UN, because I am absolutely enthralled with this idea that you did this.
Yeah, it was amazing. So every year I do this World Science Festival that happens in New York City when they get scientists from around the world. They kind of wanted to make it, it's Brian Greene and Alan Alda and a group of people that wanted to make it sort of like the Sundance Film Festival of Science.
Oh, cool.
Really cool. And it's amazing the people that they get. And so I've been involved in that for 11 years now. It's been going on. And somebody came to one of my presentations, and she was this cool mom. She was great. And I started chatting with her, and she's like, I'm actually here to stalk you. And she worked for UN Women, and she's like, I'm here because, you know, there's this meeting coming up and we really want to get your perspective on this, you know, and it's all about girls and STEM in the science fields. Particularly was the space sector field that the meeting was. But I think that the sensibility is the same, you know, because girls outperform boys all the way through college in STEM subjects.
Yep, they do.
11, they start to drop away and say, it's not me. That's not who I want to be. And I think it's all about, we've got to rebrand it. We've got to rebrand how cool science is, because honestly, we tell our kids through media, through video games, through sitcoms and movies, that being a nerd is being a nerd. It's not cool. You know, and I think in some cases we try to fix that. But even like the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because they're antisocial and weird.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, what 11-year-old girl is going to say, that's what I want to be.
No kidding. I know. Oh, I know.
Yeah. So what we need to do is just sort of make it, it's powerful. And the STEM, also, I think we need to educate our kids and ourselves about the amazing careers that are out there.
Amazing.
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
So I'm working on a project that I hope catches fire there, just that would just illuminate all these amazing jobs that are out there available for both boys and girls, so that we need both voices. We do.
Yeah. Absolutely do. And it's something I bump in again and again into, being in IT technology. Females in technology is not a standard. And I actually work with students, and almost all my students are male, and I have a handful of females. And I'm always like, you girls, we're going to back you up, because there's a few of us out there. And it just kind of goes and rings true to my heart that we need to expand the idea of what it looks like to be in science for female. For young women, I get a lot of, oh, you're a librarian? Because there's this like perception of what librarians are supposed to look like and act like. And I'm like, oh, I can tell you to be quiet in an instant. No worries on that. Yeah, so it's really, really a great project. And hopefully when your new project comes out, you'll be able to come visit us and tell us about that.
I'd love to.
Yeah. Okay. So a couple of other topics is that I am assuming with most of your titles, you're traditionally published. Is that correct? Or are you self-published, hybrid? Kind of talk us through what you are.
No, I've never done any self-publishing or hybrid. It's always been with a major publishing house. I don't think I could take on it's so much work. And also I love the collaborative I love a collaboration. I noticed that with writing for Bill Nye. It's not one person that you can look at and say, oh, that person is responsible for that show, because there's the writing, and then there's the performance, there's the directing, there's the editing, there's the music, there's all that stuff. And same with a book. When you when I teach kids about writing or being a writer, one of the things that I always say is, once you have your idea and you offer it, it becomes the world's idea. It becomes not just yours anymore. And you've got to accept that, because people that cling to their stuff and won't let anybody else in, they're not going to be successful, because it doesn't work that way. Publishers, the editor, it's their book, right? It's also the designer's book. It's the illustrator's book. And you've just got to be able to say, all these brilliant people come in and make this idea whole.
Awesome. You know what? Okay, so I lean towards self-publication. No, but this is such a great conversation for me to have, because I typically, my two main reasons is I'm a control freak. And second off, my husband came from music industry. And so we've been burnt with management and contracts and things like that in the past. And so I'm like, oh, heck, I don't need all that. You know, I can manage this all myself. But the way you just described it makes me want to buy into the idea of really pursuing traditional publishing. So in your experience, do you feel like that is because you're collaborative and you're willing to share your work and you're not taking full ownership of it, and that's why it works so well for you? Because I've heard horror stories also.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are horror stories out there. I mean, it's only been my experience. It's interesting, because there's always going to be people. You see this in any field. I saw it definitely on television and definitely in books, where people want to own it and say, well, I came up with this. Yeah. And you know, the bottom line is, you know, you didn't. I did. But I'm willing to say that, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. So there's always egos, right? There's always an ego whenever you create anything. But I do think that having all those people that come to it and want to own it and say, this is my project, makes it a stronger project, right? Mm-hmm. So if for me, writing nonfiction and science and trying to get sort of difficult concepts across, it's so worth it, right? Mm-hmm. If the product becomes better, then that's going to be better for the reader. Yeah. And so I'm looking down the pipeline, right? And I've had different experiences. Some publishers are super easy to work with editorially, and then they don't market your book. Some publishers are great at marketing, and they're really a bear to work with editorially. Yeah. But all of them pose a certain set of challenges that you just, you know, you step back and go, well, this would be, what if this were a movie? This would be an interesting scene.
Well, I adore your perspective, and thank you for sharing it, because it's going to give me food for thought to be open. Because for so long I haven't been open, because I want to keep it all to myself. And I don't, you know, I understand collaborative, because I work in a collaborative environment every day in my professional career. And we couldn't get anything done if we weren't collaborative, right? But when it comes to your story that's inside of you, it's like your baby, and I don't want to share my baby.
And then when they ask you to make edits, and you have to edit those little bits that you don't, but you know what? It doesn't mean that you have to edit them. You know, they always say, like, you got to kill a few puppies. You don't have to kill them. You take the puppies out and you put them in a different pen.
Oh gosh, I love you. Okay, so we will have personal conversations when I get to that place, and you can remind me that. It's all a growing experience for me. So good. You may have converted me to consider traditional publication. Now we'll see if anybody's ever interested in my work. It hasn't come out yet. So that's the big key, right? That it's good enough and interesting.
A little bit of a challenge there, but you know what? It's fun.
We'll see. Awesome. So what comes along with what I talk about with authors a lot, and we kind of touched on this a little bit, is the social media life. Nowadays, publication is way different. And what I found is that being active and you really have to put yourself out there. You have to really be active. Social media, you kind of have to promote yourself. I know you have a little bit of help, because I met your help in that aspect. But talking to somebody like me that's getting started out, and kind of give me or any of our listeners some tips of managing that, because I'm even finding some of my traditional published authors that come on the show, they also have to be prepared in their contracts to do this a lot more marketing and promotion than ever before, maybe in the past. So can you tell us something to give me another gem to keep me going on this one.
Well, you know, I got to say, I wish I was six people. If I was six people, I could send one of them and just have them be the social media
person. Yes, I know.
That's the hardest thing for me because I don't like the kind of self-patting on the back feeling that it makes my toes curl. But I also know that it's, you know, like if I can change it in my head from talk about me and to here I can share an idea.
Yeah.
Somebody else might enjoy and it might inspire them. Again, it's just tweaking that lens for me. Because I can't, you know, that patting on the back stuff is hard for me. Mm-hmm. I don't do it well. And I it feels canned when I do try to do it. But if I give a science fact, I can do that. Yeah. Or if I say, it's Easter, here's an egg experiment, you know, I can do that. And that's where coming back to the question about my blog, the Mama Going Geek blog, that's what all that stuff is. It's like, that content I can put out there, I'm happy about that. And if it happens to boost sales, great.
yeah, exactly. That's kind of the philosophy that I've discovered. Okay, so like I said, this podcast in the past, I've said it before, is all about me. Mm-hmm. And it ended up me going and finding these authors and asking all these questions and it being really great information. And then I know for myself, I can't keep this to myself. And so I'm like, there's other people that are probably sitting out there in the world wondering all these questions. Let's share it, right? And how that's developed is developed me into promoting the authors that I meet and the podcast and vicariously coming through and finding that I'm actually, social media for myself in a way too. But it feels better to me because it's a group. I'm doing something for a group that I love. Yeah. And let me tell you, every author that I've met have now become my friends and I love them and I want to see them successful. So I can see that aspect of it. I like that. I think all of us need to realize that it can't be just about us. It has to be about a bigger picture sometimes and it makes it easier.
So. And then, you know, I think that the point is that having social media and seeing somebody's name and seeing somebody's book over and over again, it really does make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's my hardest thing.
It is. And it's a challenge for me too. In my personal life, my manager tells me, you got to get your students to do this survey. And I'm like, I hate asking them to do a survey about me. They love me. They'll go do the survey. And then I realize, oh, they don't do it. You know? So it's like, I hate asking for that kind of stuff. So I get it. So let's talk about, the work that you're currently I wanted you to talk about because anybody that knows me and has followed my Facebook in the last year know I'm obsessed with bees, particularly mason bees. So of course I get to talk with you about this amazing project that you've done. And so first tell us the title and then we're going to talk through kind of the aspect of this book because it's a very unique book. And so we'll start with the title and share with us kind of how the idea came.
So the title is called Turn This Book Into a Beehive and 19 Other Experiments and Activities That Explore the Amazing World of Bees. And it came about as a result of, I read an article about the honeybee hive collapse, right? And it was a dire article. Mm-hmm. And it talked about how 75% of our food comes from pollination of bees, mm-hmm. and our cotton and our linen. And if we don't take care of our bees, we're going to be naked and hungry. And
yeah, I read that same article too.
Yeah.
I'm devastated.
and then it's like sort of brought you into a dark, scary cave and said the end. And I'm like, it's important to know what the problems are. But for me, that's just a beginning because
exactly.
I want to help. Well, how can we solve it? How can we fix it? How can we make a difference? And so because I love writing for kids, too, it's like I'm not going to write a scary thing for them that says, you know, we've been bad and we're bees. When the bees die, so will we. Bye-bye. So what I wanted to say is, you know what, let's see. Let's do the digging. And I found out that honeybees represent only 2% of the, social bees are 2% of the bees in the world. 98% of the rest of the bees are solitary bees. And these solitary bees are wild bees and they're uber pollinators. And actually they can pick up the slack, maybe even do the job better if we just change our lens to it.
Exactly,
And then I'm like, okay, my other soapbox, especially for science, is I want, you know, people to be able to do these experiments or projects or whatever with stuff you already have around the house. I don't think you need to buy equipment, fancy stuff. And so then I thought, well, I found out about mason bees and they live in these tubes, usually that are dug into the ground or dug into wood by other insects or hollow grasses that they find, and that they will nest in man-made tubes. So I thought, oh, and so I messed around with it and I made this little prototype of a book that where you take the dust jacket off and turn it inside out and take the last signature pages and roll them up, tuck them in. You can make this mason beehive, hang it in your garden or your yard or your fire escape if you're a city kid or you know, if you've got a pea patch nearby, but hang it up in a nice warm sunny spot and like these wild bees will come. If you build it, they will come. And I stuck one in my garden, hoping that it was true.
Experiment.
And I got mason bees. And I was the person that if I heard something buzzing, I would run the other direction. Now I hear a buzz and I'm like, oh, what are you? What are you? And when they come in and they land and it's like, oh my God, I got mason bees. And I think I had three different kinds. I had the beautiful Blue Orchard mason bee.
Oh, yes.
Fly on mm-hmm. one aspect, but when it catches the light, it's this like gorgeous blue. I had I had some red ones that are red and fuzzy, and I had some straw colored ones that were fuzzy and I was so delighted. And plus, on top of that, I had more blueberries and raspberries than I've ever had before.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's astonishing. So one thing that a lot of people don't know, besides the fact that they're the natural pollinators, you know, they're natural to your environment, is that tell us a little bit about the difference between them and bees in the sense of stings and possible things like that, because people are afraid of bees. I'm not.
So honeybees and bumblebees, the bees that make honey, these social bees, they're the ones that are going to sting. And it's interesting, there's a scientific reason for that. They've got a lot of information and hard work that they're trying to protect. Because they live in a social hive, which means there's one queen, and all the worker bees, they're all female, are working to protect her and feed her. They gather all the pollen, they make the honey. It's all to protect the queen and her baby. She's the only person passing on genetic information, right? So that's a huge investment. And because they're all females, they all have the same anatomy as the queen, but she's the only one using her anatomy to lay eggs. It's the same thing. It's called an ovipositor. The worker bees, they have venom in there and they sting to protect that hive. Whereas with mason bees and solitary bees, every girl's a queen. And so
love that.
Like a single mom, she goes out, she finds a place to live, she goes and she gets the food, she makes a pile of food, she lays an egg on the top of the pile of food, she goes out and she gets the mud, she comes back, she spackles it. She doesn't have time, she's not going to sting, they're friendly. And if you mess with them, I think they will poke you, but there's no venom, so they're not going to hurt you at all. And that's not their intention. In fact, it's really not their intention to hurt you with a social beehive either. It's their intention to say, back off. We got lives here, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
They're not to be frightened of. And especially when you put one in your garden, you know, you're not going to get the bees that come and sting you. You're going to get bees that are, you know, going to fly around and pollinate your flowers and do an amazing job.
And so that's why the way you constructed your book is perfect for kids or a family with kids, because they can read all about these special pollinators. I like to call them special, but you know, the natural pollinators, and then they can create a hive to put out, and then they don't have to worry about their kids coming and watching and getting close to them, especially, you know, because a lot of people have they're allergic to bees too. So they want to, you know, keep their, but these, you don't have to, they're fabulous.
They really are fabulous. I love that they're fuzzy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The mason bees are fuzzy, and that makes them these amazing pollinators because they're sloppy. They body slam a blossom. They roll all around, they cover with pollen, and they're looking for the nectar and the pollen, and then they go to the next flower and they body slam that one. And so they are amazing pollinators because their fuzzy bodies carry pollen from blossom to blossom. So a social bee, a honey bee, is elegant and a little bit less fuzzy. Mm-hmm. And get some pollen on them, and they pollinate, I would say, they're solid pollinators. Mason bees pollinate 95% of the time.
Wow.
So, like, you know, talk about mic drop for the bees, but
you're kidding.
You know, one mason bee can pollinate as many flowers as 100 honeybees.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah. So what's the projection from what you have read and understood? Because I follow this, but not all of our listeners may follow this awesome topic. If you don't, you should. But what's our projection for the honeybee hive and the collapse, you know, of the honeybee hive versus right now? Because I know that report, I think, came out, or reports came around 2016. And I've heard a little bit of different story lately.
Well, you know, and it's up and down. And the thing is, like, there's so many stories out there. I know that there's people who are exploring creating little bee drones, which will work for pollination. But honestly, you can look to the native pollination, native populations, and that's going to do a lot too. I know there's some almond growers and definitely some orchard growers, especially here in Washington.
Yeah.
That are incorporating these mason bees and bringing them in and getting good results with that. So I'm hoping that that's something that kind of picks up steam as we go along. Nobody really knows what the honeybee hive collapse is. Like, it's a bunch of things, right? There's a nasty little mite that lives in the honeybee. Mm-hmm. It's also a nasty little mite that can live in the mason bee.
Yeah, I found some of those last year. My guys, yeah.
It's inevitable, but we can, you know, like changing out the tubes helps and all that
stuff.
You know, is it the pesticides that we're using to get rid of? So there's a section in the book that talks about natural pesticides that are not going to be breaking down the environment. Because if you think about, if you're spraying a weed killer or a bug killer, you're spraying something that is killing a life form, which is much smaller than us. So it's not going to kill us, but it's going to build up and there's a toxin there. But if you're just sort of trying to, you know, get them to move on, you can use things like vinegar and baking soda and even garlic whirled up in the blender, you know, and water and spread. And these are strong, strong chemicals, but they're strong natural chemicals that are not going to be toxic to us. And so there's ways to, you know, it's like addressing all of these things. I read an article that suggested that it was cell phone tower that was collapsing the honeybees, but I don't think that's true. It might add to it. We don't know. But I think we have to be, you know, mindful about what we're moving forward with. We're just overtaxing these poor bees because we want their honey. And and then, you know, the honeybee keepers are moving these hives around the country, having to pollinate great swaths of farmland. And that's a lot of pressure for these things. And it's extended their natural span of when they would be hunting and pollinating for food. So I think we're exhausting them too. I just think, you know, bringing in these, and you're right. So, you know, one thing that I thought was fascinating is that honeybees are all imports, right? They were brought in by the colonists. And mankind has been beekeeping since caveman days. They have carvings in the sides of caves of people tending hives. And so that genetic population is a pretty, if you think about it, it's a pretty small swath of a population. And then we've got our wild bees that are coming in that have huge genetic diversity. So that's going to help too.
Yeah. Awesome.
I think there's hope.
I do too. And I'm a believer in the hope. I really do. So once again, any of my family and friends that know me know this about me. So my listeners that don't know this know that I'm a little bit of a tree hugger in the sense that if a neighbor is cutting down a tree next door to us, I will have a panic attack and I will go out and investigate why the tree is going down if it's healthy. And I've been known to get really upset if there's no reason to cut the tree down because they just want to cut it down. Or, you know, some of our other neighbors like to, you know, use pesticides, lots of pesticides. And I don't use anything in our garden. And I have animals, you know, and I really freak out about it. And I stomp around the house kind of mad. I'm like, I'm going to kill my environment. My bees aren't going to live. And I just get really upset because I do think there's some education that we need to do for the future generations of how we can really steward this beautiful country that's been given to us and the nature's been given to us. And us who live in the Pacific Northwest, we tend to know how beautiful we live in.
Yeah, that's true.
And fortunate.
So, I also think with this book, what I really wanted to do is put it in the hands of kids because they are stewards of
absolutely.
And we do want to make a difference. And, you know, this I sort of see it as this environmental power tool, because if every kid did this and brought these native populations into their, you know, they could change the world.
I was just thinking that. And so when you were talking about your book, I'm like, this could be a game changer for a lot of areas, a lot of kids. It could even really teach kids to love their environment in such a way that we might see some amazing stewards of the environment grow up and say, I've read Lynn's book and I had my first beehive and it was that's what's inspired me. So any of my listeners, if this rings true to you and you want to pass this along to your kids, your grandkids, or even your neighbor's kids, you know, find this book and get it and make sure that you can share with them the joys of these amazing pollinators Lynn and I have discovered and fallen madly in love with, because I am in love with them too.
And then, you know, just gardeners who want a better gardener.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mason bees are, they're the thing.
And that's how I found out about them. So early spring, I was listening to a podcast from a gal, and I can't remember her name, unfortunately, but she does a whole podcast on moving from the city into a rural lifestyle and living off of the land. And I am always intrigued by that. I don't know if I'll ever do anything like that, but I'm intrigued by it. So I was listening to her podcast about canning and things like that. And she brought in the one of the United States Mason Bee experts. That's when I heard about them for the first time. And that was it. I'm like, my husband and I'm like, we are on the hunt for a Mason Bee hive this year. And we did, we got a hive. I actually was able to see one hatch. I had him inside the house because it was still too cold, and one hatched out, and I have a picture of him on my hand or her. And I was like totally ecstatic. That day was like, I'm taking pictures. I wrote a blog post on my old blog about it, lost a million people because they didn't know what I was talking about. Like, these guys, you don't get, but a lot of my friends and family know I'm very obsessed with them. My mom even bought me a cute little bee thing for Christmas, for my Christmas present, because it's just something that I'm passionate about. So I'm so glad that you're on the podcast and share with us this title and this book, but also that you're sharing with our newer generations that are coming up to help them get excited about how they can really easily, and gardeners can really easily, change the tide of what we've seen already with bees overall. We can see a huge change to happen in our future. And it's really simple. And you don't have to do anything. You just put the stuff out there and they take care of themselves.
It's empowering. And these kids, you know, I feel good about our generations that are coming up, and they do have a lot of power, and I want them to know it.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. So Lynn, here's one last question that I'm going to take us out. So I listeners, I know that this is a completely different format. I hope you enjoyed this format because it was so much fun for me. But I'm going to ask Lynn the one question I ask a lot of my authors. So for our listeners that don't know you yet, and this is their first exposure to you, and now they're going to be flooding your Facebook and your Instagram and your website to find out all about you, I hope. Can you share with us what your future looks like as far as your future writing? What's kind of on the horizon for us so we can keep an eye out?
Well, I mean, I'm always looking to make kind of complex concepts accessible. That's my thing. And make it, so basically, I love projects, science projects, art projects. I like making things available and fun and easy to do with stuff that you already have around the house, or making you think in such a different way that you like, I never thought about that, because this world is pretty amazing. And so if you could just sort of get a peek at it and have some kids just go, hey, that's really cool, you know, and just sort of get inspired by it. That's what gets me. So all of my stuff aims toward that.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, we'll be watching out for all the good stuff coming. You do appearances in schools from what I hear.
I do.
If you're in the greater Northwest area, you may find Lynn at the school with your kids, which is fantastic. If you're not in the school district, I would think that some of Lynn's materials would be fantastic for homeschoolers with her experiments. So if you're in homeschooling, look at her website and see if there's any of her books that you can incorporate into your education of your students at home. Because that was the one thing I thought of, like, man, if I was homeschooling, I'd be grabbing some of Lynn's stuff. Because
a lot of my stuff is used. I get a lot of people that come up and say that, or even after school stuff too.
Like, yeah, after school's great too. Yeah. Yeah.
But I do come to visit schools on my website. There's a whole section about school visits. Yeah.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Lynn, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed it. I hope our listeners enjoyed it. I hope they were inspired. And more than anything, I was totally inspired to think a different way, which is super exciting. And I hope that we can have you back when you have another book out so we can share that with everybody.
I look forward to it.
Awesome. Thanks. Thank you for listening to the podcast. We hoped you loved hearing from the author as much as we did. If you did enjoy the author, make sure you find them on social media, buy their book, and write a review. Are you a published author and would like to be featured on the podcast? Visit us at our website to learn more. You can help support the production of this podcast
by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Share the podcast with your friends. And most importantly, become a supporter. Supporters receive monthly bonus podcasts and a newsletter filled with tips from our authors. To find out more how to become a supporter, visit our website. And finally, I hope you always remember to enjoy the journey. Until next week, this is Vicki J. Carter saying goodbye.